Insiders, it's Tamara Supper. I'm the executive producer at Cafe. I'm excited to share a new project. It's called Office Hours. Every so often, I'll be speaking with experts about undercovered issues of law and policy. Our topic today, lethal drone strikes. The New York Times recently reported that the military significantly undercounts civilian deaths that result from U.S. airstrikes, often due to, quote, patterns of failed intelligence, decision-making, and execution. To help provide context to the latest revelations and to explain the laws and policies that underpin the use of lethal drone strikes, I spoke with Priyanka Motaparthy. She is the director of Project on Counterterrorism, Armed Conflict, and Human Rights at Columbia University's Human Rights Institute. Priyanka Motaparthy, thank you so much for joining me on Office Hours.
Thank you for having me, Tamara.
So I'm so excited to have you because you have many years of expertise in the very subject matter we're talking about today, and that, of course, is targeted killings. Recently, the New York Times has had a series of articles reporting that the military significantly undercounts civilian casualties. Furthermore, the Times reports that a lot of these civilian deaths are a result of systemic failures. Quote, patterns of failed intelligence, decision-making, and execution. What was your reaction to these articles when you read them?
Thanks for that question. You know, I would say the New York Times reporting was extraordinary. What they did, it was the product of, you know, several years worth of work to get the documents that they procured. They, you know, retrieved more than 1,000 documents of how the military investigates civilian casualties. And at the same time, I would say that the conclusions that they came to are really problems that, you know, many people working in this area, human rights advocates, civilian protection groups, humanitarian groups, have been flagging for years, if not decades. These are not new problems. And what was extraordinary about the reporting is the level at which they proved them and the sort of depth and, you know, detail of the evidence they provided, really laying out through these documents and through the on-the-ground reporting that they did, both the human faces of this problem, as well as the systemic problems in the military's way of investigating these issues. And so, you know, some of the things they concluded, like that cases were dismissed on trivial reasons, that there was, you know, repeated use of bad intelligence or inadequate intelligence, that the same types of problems kept cropping up again and again. Again, these are problems that we've seen before and that, you know, various groups have documented and made clear, including to the military itself. There are problems that the military has also studied. They've done their own internal studies of how civilian casualties come about and found some of these problems. But over two decades, they've not been remedied.
So it's fair to say that none of this reporting came as a surprise to you.
I think the conclusions were not surprising, but, you know, again, the level of detail and the quality of the reporting and the, you know, extent to which they established these problems that we've known about was extraordinary.
I want to go back and cover some basics here for our listeners to help them understand the core principles and the laws that are applicable in this area. But before we even get to that, which military outfits are in charge of carrying out drone strikes? Because there have been times we've heard the CIA, although they haven't acknowledged it, is behind some of the drone strikes. Of course, the Pentagon, and then within the Pentagon, some elite units. What is your understanding of who carries out drone strikes and where?
So when we're speaking about the Middle East, the primary unit carrying out drone strikes or airstrikes, you know, lethal airstrikes as well, is U.S. Central Command. This is the military combatant command responsible for military operations in the Middle East, which the U.S. military defines as including Afghanistan as well. They are based in MacDill Air Force Base, which is in Florida. And they are one of several geographic commands. The U.S. military has divided the world up into regional areas, and there's a command responsible for each region. So in this case, you know, operations in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, etc., you know, fall under U.S. Central Command. But you mentioned elite units. It's true that we've learned through the New York Times reporting certain elite units, special ops, have been responsible for some lethal force operations, including airstrikes that have killed, you know, potentially significant numbers of civilians. But we also understood from the Times reporting that they continue to fall under U.S. Central Command. You also mentioned the CIA, and this is a very, you know, important, much criticized part of the U.S. drone program, because as much as, you know, the U.S. military is, you know, carrying out these operations, including outside of recognized armed conflict, and there's very little accountability for what happens in those incidents, the CIA is even more secretive, more unaccountable, and we really don't know when or where they carry out operations except for in rare instances. There used to be a provision that required the U.S. government to report these drone strikes, including CIA operations, but that has not been, you know, that was done away with under the Trump administration, and we haven't seen that type of reporting since Obama's years.
Do we have a rough sense of how many civilian deaths have occurred at the hands of United States government using airstrikes specifically to target Al-Qaeda and associated forces?
So this is a number that the U.S. government itself has never published. There has not been transparency on this. We don't even know that they're tracking it or evaluating civilian casualties in this way. There's an independent group, a civilian protection monitoring group called Air Wars, which has done tremendous work in terms of creating their own methodology and producing data on U.S. operations abroad. And they did an analysis recently and found that, you know, between 22 and 41,000 civilians have been killed in the U.S. post 9/11 wars. That's a very broad estimate. It's a very challenging thing to count, particularly as an external civilian group. And it's certainly something that advocates have been asking the U.S. to be transparent about. How can we carry out these operations if we cannot understand the human toll that they extract, the cost on local communities, on local families, in the places where the U.S. is carrying out these operations? How can there be any accountability to the American public for what the government is doing in the name of their safety and well-being? So it's an extremely important question, and it's a question that has yet gone unanswered by the U.S. government.
The Times, in one of its articles, looked at 1,300 Pentagon assessments of civilian casualty allegations, and of that 1,300, it deemed 1,100 to be non-credible, and therefore no further investigation would be done. Do you know how the military decides when it gets these allegations of civilian casualties, whether one is credible or not credible?
We know something about how that determination is made. We know some of it through the Times reporting analysis. We've, you know, heard answers from the military themselves. You know, I personally have submitted reports to the military and had them deemed, you know, either credible or non-credible. Generally, people submitting reports to the U.S. military are not told why their allegation is deemed credible or non-credible. It's just a determination that the military comes to. But from, you know, the Times reporting and other sources, we know that reports have been dismissed for certain reasons. One is the U.S. military will say, we simply did not carry out strikes in the area in question. But what the Times found is that the military did not always keep comprehensive or accurate logs of where they were carrying out strikes, particularly in an operation like the operation to clear ISIS from Mosul. There were, numerous strikes happening every day at a high volume, at a fast pace, and apparently not everything was logged. And so reports were reportedly dismissed because the people submitting it were told there were no strikes in that area, when in fact that there were. So there's a problem of, military records that are not comprehensive, that are not always kept as thoroughly as they should be. And so reports can get dismissed for that reason. They can also get dismissed for, reasons the military may not deem the individual civilians. They use a different interpretation of the laws of war than most human rights advocates do. And so they may be, using a different way of defining whether or not they can target someone.
So you mean they're not considering a civilian to, in fact, be a non-combatant?
Exactly. Exactly. And then there's also, questions of uncertainty. They may not always know for sure one way or the other, but they do not presume that people are civilians when they don't really know their status. They presume that they are targetable.
So is the presumption basically if you're with a known terrorist, say, you're presumed to be guilty in a sense?
I would say it's not necessarily that you're presumed to be guilty, but you are, there's a proportionality analysis that happens. And so the value of targeting one individual, given their role or function in an extremist group, could be seen to outweigh, the presence of other civilians or people who the military doesn't know what function they carry out.
Looking at the patterns that are emerging here, what would you say are the biggest systemic reasons behind why these civilian deaths are occurring in these airstrikes?
I think there's a few different reasons. So first of all, you have cases where civilians are misidentified as legitimate targets. And that was what we saw happen in Kabul. You had a civilian individual, humanitarian aid worker, who the military, through confirmation bias, decided was up to some activities that were threatening the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, that were threatening U.S. soldiers' lives. And so they carried out the airstrike that ultimately, as I'm sure you know, killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. So misidentification is quite a serious problem. There's an analyst named Larry Lewis, who used to work for the U.S. government, he used to work for the Department of Defense, in fact, and conducted an analysis of the reasons behind civilian deaths. And he found that a significant portion of civilian deaths in Afghanistan were due to misidentification. And it's something he has identified as a serious problem. And it's something that we've seen through, reporting and investigations by human rights groups as well. So that's one problem. A second problem is civilians who are killed when the military is indeed striking a legitimate target, but they either, they may not know about the presence of civilians, or they may underestimate the presence of civilians for a variety of reasons.
So when confronted with the facts of civilian deaths, the government seldomly but will admit that it has made mistakes, and it will say, look, drones are precise, but mistakes still do happen. And I'm just wondering, how avoidable do you think these mistakes are for the government? And what are the sorts of mistakes that we should tolerate, understanding that mistakes do happen? And where do we draw the line on the types of mistakes that should not be tolerated?
I think that's such a good question. Because of course, you know, everyone can make mistakes in their work. We can't hold them up to, you know, an unrealistic standard where, you know, zero mistakes are made. And I don't think anyone is advocating for that. But at the same time, there has to be an effort to learn, you know, when mistakes are made. Is the military sufficiently carrying out its investigation to understand what went wrong? Are they truly identifying the causes of these problems? And then when they do identify these problems, are they really, you know, returning back to their process, baking that knowledge into, you know, what happens going forward to ensure that they're not going to keep carrying out the same types of mistakes over and over and over again? And I think we have really not seen those lessons being learned, which is why you have, you know, strikes like that August 29th Kabul airstrike happening. You know, we were told it was the heat of the moment, it was a dynamic atmosphere, everything was happening very quickly. But we've been told, you know, time and time again that the military is deeply skilled and experienced in carrying out precisely those kinds of strikes when things are moving quickly, you know, when there's a lot of pressure. And so, you know, I think, you know, the mistakes we saw in that strike are actually emblematic of mistakes that we've seen that caused civilian deaths, you know, many times in Afghanistan, but also in Iraq, in Syria, as well as outside of recognized conflict. You know, we've seen bad intelligence, confirmation bias, these types of errors happen in numerous occasions. And so I think when you see patterns of mistakes happening over and over again, that's when you know that policies need to have more serious change.
We know that learning from our mistakes is easier said than done, but it has been 20 years. And I'm wondering whether you believe the government is acting in good faith.
I think that, you know, I would like to believe that they are. Certainly, you know, this administration has really defined itself in terms of its commitment to human rights, to moral accountability, to transparency, to racial justice, to adherence to international law and good governance, rule of law. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity there to actualize those commitments. At the same time, I think a lot of work needs to be done. The government and the Department of Defense needs to really recognize that these are not one-off events. These are not sort of, you know, bad apples or extraordinary or unique in some way. You know, what we learned from, you know, these types of airstrikes where civilians are killed when they're truly investigated and, you know, some of the reasons come out is that these are problems that extend far more broadly than just one incident or, you know, a few unique incidents.
I want to go back to discuss the legal framework around targeted killings. How are targeted killings defined and what distinguishes them from assassinations, as we saw, for example, with the killing of Iranian General Qassem Soleimani, assassinations, of course, being against U.S. policy?
So targeted killings is not a legal term. It's a descriptive term. And it's one that was used at some points in time to describe drone strikes outside of recognized armed conflict. You know, I think it was, it's just a descriptive term that is, you know, perhaps less offensive or less controversial than assassinations. But certain targeted killings are assassinations. And it's just a different, more palatable way to describe them. And, you know, advocates, human rights advocates and others working in this field, we've moved away from using the term targeted killings because targeted implies a certain level of precision that you're, you know, aiming for something, that you're accurate. And what we've seen time and time again in these drone strikes is that, in fact, you know, civilians have been targeted on numerous occasions. The targeting, you know, the people have been targeted who are not meant to be targeted. There's been a significant civilian toll to this program. And so now we refer to them as, you know, lethal strikes outside of recognized armed conflict or, you know, drone strikes. If they are drone strikes, there can also be lethal airstrikes not carried out by drones.
The legal framework around lethal strikes is very complex, but I'm wondering if you could give us a broad understanding of how the government has legally justified lethal strikes and what the key issues are for legal analysis.
So I think there are, you know, as you say, it is such a complex issue. It's something that I've spent a lot of time learning about and familiarizing myself with. And, you know, there's many different nuances to it. And, you know, what I would say is that there are, governments are allowed to kill people in the context of armed conflict. But war is meant to be a temporary state of exception. We are not meant to live in a state of permanent, endless war. And the problem is when you start using lethal force outside of, you know, what is recognized as armed conflict, then you are, you know, arguing that the world is a battlefield, and that war is boundless in both time and space. And that is a very, very dangerous precedent to set. And that is why the U.S. drone program has been so controversial, because it has really stretched the limits of and really eroded some of the international legal protections that are meant to protect us against exactly that scenario. And so you have these, you know, killings, these lethal strikes happening in situations where international law and international human rights law would deem them illegal, extrajudicial killings. And yet the U.S. government has pursued this policy and has justified it through justifications around self-defense, which is being used far more broadly and expansively and elastically than is meant to be. And justifications, you know, domestic legal justifications that this is all part of a post-9/11 war. But we are now more than 20 years since 9/11. And I don't think anyone, whether those in government or, you know, the American public, know when this is meant to end. You know, when will these justifications stop being ones that can be used? And so I think that precedent is sort of endless, boundless war is a very dangerous one.
It feels like as long as there are terrorist groups in existence, most probably anywhere, will be engaged in a non-international armed conflict with these groups. Is that a fair assessment?
This is the scenario that, you know, my organization and many other advocacy groups have been strenuously, you know, warning against and trying to avoid. I don't think, you know, I can't imagine who would want to be in a state of endless war. And certainly there are other tools for dealing with some of the problems these groups present, you know, diplomacy, peace building, you know, like development programs. There are other ways for addressing some of these problems. And certainly the drone program has created problems, even as, you know, attempted to solve them. It has, you know, angered communities. It has left them impoverished, left families without, you know, breadwinners, left them with serious tragedies that they live with for the rest of their lives. And, you know, these are these are destabilizing events, both for families and communities. They're destabilizing economically, socially, psychologically. And so none of these seem to be constructive effects in addressing the problem of terrorism.
Let's talk about the procedure. Help us understand, what are the rules of engagement here? Before the military orders a lethal drone strike, what type of procedure and analysis does it undertake?
So, you know, again, I'm not a military expert, but what we understand from conversations with the military and how they explain the precautions they take to avoid striking civilians is that they, you know, plan a strike based on intelligence. That could be intelligence from overhead, from overflight surveillance. It could be intelligence from sources on the ground. It could be intelligence, signals intelligence, you know, communications that are picked up and interpreted. But, you know, through some form of intelligence, they identify what can be a target. Or, you know, it could be in the context of an armed conflict, they're, you know, they need to carry out a strike because they're being fired upon, and then it's self-defense. But through various processes, they identify what they're going to target. Then they run a legal analysis to see if they believe themselves to be in compliance with the laws of war. The strike is, you know, approved or not approved, and then it's carried out. So this is what we understand to be the situation. And in, you know, certain circumstances where a strike is pre-planned, you know, including long in advance, they, you know, carry out what's called a pattern of life analysis. They try to understand, you know, how, you know, what is the civilian presence in the area? Are there going to be, who's going to be around? When should they plan a strike? Who might be affected? Who is living in a particular building? Who, when do people, you know, go outside or go to the market or go to a particular civilian site that may be near what they're planning to strike? So they're meant to do that type of analysis as well. But we also know that in other circumstances, you know, what are called dynamic strikes, which happen much more quickly and don't have the same level of planning, all of that gets compressed into a very short time frame.
And is this analysis the gist of the precautions the government takes to mitigate civilian casualties and property damage?
So in the case of civilians, you know, they do their observation, they, you know, carry out their pattern of life analysis, they look at their intelligence. In some cases, they may, you know, collaborate with local partners. In the case of property damage, they, you know, we don't have a good understanding of what steps, if any, the military takes to avoid property damage. You know, we've never gotten the sense that this is a significant part of their calculations. There's no public reporting or, you know, accounting of property damage. It's really something we don't see a lot of reporting on or a lot of discussion about in terms of the military and, you know, civilian harm. It's something that advocates have been trying to raise to their attention and create more discussion of and more protection for, because of course, when you damage civilian property, you could be, you know, destroying someone's livelihood, you could be destroying their home. Again, that's not always illegal, but in certain circumstances, it would be. So, you know, I think there certainly needs to be more attention paid to civilian property damage as well.
The government has said that it needs to be nearly certain that non-combatants will not be killed or injured before it orders a drone strike. How has it defined near certainty?
So near certainty was a standard that was used under the Obama administration. But the standard currently used is actually that of reasonable certainty. And you saw this after the drone strike in Afghanistan on August 29th that killed 10 civilians. The military afterwards justifying its actions by saying, well, you know, there was reasonable certainty that we were striking a legitimate target. You know, how are these terms defined? I think there's a lot of, certainly in the term reasonable certainty, there seems to be a fair amount of elasticity. You know, as long as they're acting in good faith based on the information that they had at the time and taking sort of the necessary precautions, you know, then I suppose that's reasonable certainty.
It was also policy to capture targets, terrorist targets, instead of killing them when feasible. Is that still the case?
This is something we've actually asked the U.S. military, you know, if it's something that they're incorporating into their planning, you know, because, you know, we have identified, so my organization, the Columbia Human Rights Institute, has worked with a leading Yemeni human rights organization, Watana for Human Rights, and we reported several cases of civilian harm, including deaths and injuries in Yemen, to the U.S. government because they were carried out in U.S. operations. And we did ask, you know, was capture considered in these circumstances? Because in some of these cases, you know, people were members of the Yemeni military. And so they could have asked their ally, the Yemeni government, to help apprehend this person, or the person, you know, traveled and could have been captured at that point in time. You know, various circumstances in particular cases led us to believe that capture would have been feasible. And so we did ask, you know, why that was not the route taken, but we've never gotten an answer to that question. And I have also not seen any reporting of captures. It's not something I've seen much about. And so it may be technically still an option, but it's certainly not one that we see being exercised a lot.
If they were to be captured, would they just be sent to Guantanamo Bay? Or what would even happen with the detainees?
I don't know what would happen to them. And perhaps that's part of the reason why this isn't happening. You know, new individuals are not being transferred to Guantanamo. That would be highly controversial given, you know, not only the tremendous public advocacy to close it, it's been now open for 20 years, the 20th anniversary was 2 days ago, but given Biden's own promise to close Guantanamo. So, you know, one can imagine they could work with, you know, partner governments or something of that nature. But yeah, they would not go to Guantanamo.
You've mentioned the sort of wing that goes on in the decision making of whether to order a strike. What's the military gain on the one hand, and what is the collateral damage on the other hand in terms of civilian lives? What's considered disproportionate when it comes to the amount of collateral damage as compared to the military advantage that's expected?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and it's a very nuanced one. So, you know, what is considered proportional is heavily dependent on the facts of a particular situation and the context. You know, it depends on the military advantage being gained, which, you know, may be influenced by who is being targeted or what is being targeted, what role that person plays, or what, you know, function that structure has, as well as the sort of number of civilians present, the evidence about their civilian status. So, you know, it's very context specific, but I think the problems that we've really seen has been when the military has failed to sufficiently detect civilian presence. So we've heard problems, for example, where they're looking at a particular video frame, and the frame is not you know, they look for a few seconds and take a strike, and then civilians come into the frame, or civilians are just outside of the frame. Or, you know, in certain contexts when people are sheltering in basements and they're not going outside because the situation is very, you know, violent and unsafe for them, and they just stay inside almost 24 hours a day. And so, you know, then they're not detected because they're always staying inside buildings. There was a famous case in Mosul where there were more than 100 people sheltering in the basement of an apartment building. And, you know, the military took a strike and they'd been observing for 3 days and they didn't see activity. So, you know, they assumed that there were no people there. And in fact, there was a huge amount of civilians there. So these are some of the circumstances during which, you know, we see problems.
In the cases where there is disproportionate amount of collateral damage, especially in terms of civilian lives, what repercussions, if any, are there for the military?
In certain cases, you know, I mean, I think the issue that advocates have really tried to flag is a real lack of accountability for these civilian deaths. As I mentioned, you know, the laws of war do permit civilian deaths in real armed conflicts. But I think when you have drone strikes outside of armed conflicts, there's a very different standard. And even within armed conflicts, there are rules and restrictions on the circumstances under which civilians can be killed. And yet I think we see again and again strikes wherein civilians are being killed, based on, you know, misidentification, confirmation bias, conjecture, or supposition. And, you know, we don't see any accountability after the fact. And in fact, we see real failures of accountability. Some of the recent Times reporting on this topic, you know, described an incident in Baghouz, Syria, where, you know, military officers themselves, legal officers within the military, flagged an incident as a potential war crime. And yet it went uninvestigated, you know, under-investigated for more than 2 years. And so I think we see a situation in which there's a real crisis of accountability for these types of incidents.
Congress has authorized $3 million a year to compensate for deaths, injuries, property damage that was caused by U.S. armed forces. What do you make of these so-called condolence payments? And what would you regard as appropriate reparations for victims of these strikes?
So those payments are known as ex gratia payments, and they are specifically defined as payments that are made at a commander's discretion to individuals who may have been harmed by the U.S. military. They're not in any way an admission of fault, and they're not meant to reflect kind of they're not meant to be compensation or reparations. They're just sort of a I'm sorry payment. And they're given in an entirely discretionary way. We've always been told that they're given at a commander's discretion if they fulfill, you know, U.S. interests. So it's a very, you know, vague and broad program that has been just very underutilized. Last year, we learned that, you know, in the previous year, no ex gratia payments were made. Not a single person was compensated for harm in U.S. strikes. And so that, I think, tells you something about how broken this program is. You know, it was intended to provide some sort of recognition of harm, some, you know, sort of relief to individuals who've suffered very serious harm at the hands of the U.S. military. And the fact that not even $1 of that was used is shocking.
So what happens to the money? Is it just sitting there unused?
I don't actually know what happens to it. It does sit there unused, you know.
I remember in 2016, the Obama administration actually paid $3 million to an Italian aid worker that was killed in a drone strike. He had been held hostage by Al-Qaeda, I believe. And then through months and months of negotiations, the government did pay his family $3 million. And I'm bringing this up just to point out the inconsistency in how cases seem to be treated and, you know, what's regarded by one commander as U.S. interest might be something completely different in a different case.
I mean, I would say it's not just inconsistency, but racial discrimination and inequity, you know? That was also the only case up until that point where we had seen an official apology. You know, President Obama apologized to the family of the Italian man who was killed, as well as I think there was another individual who was killed. I don't remember his nationality. But, you know, he issued a public apology to those people and their families. And that kind of recognition is just vanishingly rare. And the type of compensation you describe is also just vanishingly rare. And we see, you know, of course, it makes perfect sense, you know, Western families with, you know, greater access to the media and the ability to communicate in English and, you know, potentially, you know, higher representation or what have you, you know, will get greater recognition than, you know, Somali families living in remote areas where they're not even able to access proper communications, cannot communicate in English. Families living in remote parts of Yemen where there, again, are, you know, very few communication networks and just, you know, not the same type of access to media or to recourse of any kind. And so, you know, these cases are treated in very inequitable ways. And, you know, even within countries, you see these inequities. So families that are, you know, wealthier or more politically connected can mount greater campaigns to get resources, whereas families that are truly, you know, at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale or, you know, have very few access to resources will have a much more difficult time getting attention to what's happened to them.
Is there a role here for a court or some other independent body to sanction and review drone strikes, or do you see too many challenges with that kind of arrangement?
I mean, there's meant to be a judicial element to all of this, right? If conduct within the military is so egregious, if, you know, a strike is carried out that is, you know, a potential war crime, there is meant to be access to the military justice system. That's what it's there for. But we very rarely see any kind of legal recourse being pursued in these cases. And, you know, at most we see kind of internal disciplinary sanctions in terms of accountability that are, you know, not really public. And so, you know, again, this is part of the accountability crisis that we, you know, we really don't see anything beyond sort of discretionary measures and even those in just rare cases.
Based on our conversation, a listener might conclude that drone strikes are just the worst policy ever. But what are the alternatives? Are they still preferable to, say, boots on the ground or some other military sort of operations?
I think, I mean, first of all, you know, just to be very explicit, you know, my organization and an entire coalition of advocacy groups and a wide range of advocacy groups, nonprofits, you know, faith-based groups, veterans groups, et cetera, have all called for an end to the program of lethal strikes outside of recognized armed conflict. In 2021, in June, over 100 groups called for an end to this program because of how secretive, how unaccountable, and how, you know, outside the bounds of what we understand is, you know, the restrictions of international law the program has been. So, you know, to be clear, you know, I and many others have called for an end to this program because we don't think it has been a good program by any means. In terms of the alternatives, what we've called for are, you know, more investment in peacebuilding measures, in diplomacy, in development, just other, you know, other forms of trying to address some of the root causes of these problems.
So you've had this distinguished career in this area of human rights crises and global atrocities previous to your current role at the Columbia University Law School Human Rights Institute. You were at the Human Rights Watch, where you were the director of emergencies. Can you talk about the arc of your career a bit and what drew you to this work?
Of course. I've been in this field for, you know, over a decade. I think I entered it very much feeling like, as a U.S. citizen, I had some sort of role to play, some sort of responsibility to take for U.S. actions in the world. I was thinking about this, you know, at a time when the U.S. was carrying out war in Iraq, a war that I didn't believe in, that I went out into the streets and protested against. And I felt very upset at the policies and, you know, actions that my government was taking in the world. I felt that I didn't have a lot of, you know, say in what was happening, and yet people were being harmed, you know, in my name or, you know, on my behalf. And so I wanted to better understand the truth of how these policies were impacting people in places like Iraq and Syria and Yemen. I wanted to hear, you know, other people's side of the story. And I wanted to do work to try and improve some of the policies and practices that appeared most harmful to me at that point in time.
Priyanka Motuparthi, thank you so much for doing this work and for joining me on Office Hours.
Thank you for having me, Tamara.
That's it for this edition of Office Hours. I'm your host and executive producer, Tamara Sepper. The video and audio producer and composer is Nat Wiener. Thanks again to my guest, Priyanka Motuparthi. As always, send us your questions to letters@cafe.com.